So again, it's good to be together. And over the past few weeks, we've been studying, beginning a study on the kings of Israel, on the nation really itself. And so this is kind of a big scope study. So I know there's going to be scriptures. I could go on and on forever looking at all the different texts. We've tried to narrow the text down somewhat for time's sake and to give us big picture ideas. I'm sure there are scriptures you think about that maybe pop into your head that maybe I don't deal with necessarily in this study, and I don't do that purposely, but I've got to try to narrow down the scope a little bit about what we're talking about. But as we go on, hopefully through this study, we get a better understanding of the history of the nation of Israel and how we can make application from what they endured, what they did, things that occurred, and make application to us living even now in the 21st century. So as we are reminded of where we are, we've looked at the establishment of the nation in our previous studies. And last week, we began looking at the at God establishing Israel as a nation and God making a covenant with them. And of course, we took all that back to that covenant God made with Abraham and how there's deep connections with all that. And all that is playing out of those promises God made to Abraham. And then as we were ending our class, or the second half of it, we were looking at how God established judges to be over the nation of Israel. In our last leaders class, one of the things we do as part of our memory exercise is memorizing and going over those judges and who they were. But when we think about God establishing judges, why did he do that? Why didn't God, right out from the outset, establish a king? Why do it the way he did? And that's part of what we're talking about. And we'll get into that if we get into the study tonight. Why didn't God just, from the very beginning, set a judge, somebody to rule over them, maybe in the vein of a Moses? But as we get into our study tonight, we're going to see how Israel is really different at the time of Judges than the nations around them. As you begin 1 Samuel, and you have Eli being the judge over the nation of Israel, Israel is set up differently. God did that on purpose, and we'll talk about why. But they don't like being different, and they're worried about their future. And we'll talk about why that is as well. But then they begin to cry out, God, give us a king. And so they do that. God decides to give them what they're asking for, but he gives them a warning that was important for them to listen to. And in the monks of that discussion, we'll talk about why did God set things up the way he did? And I think there's an application to even today, and we'll get into that, about even the way the church is established and how it's really different than what we see in the world. I think you can see a distinction between the church as established in the New Testament and then the way the world has established its churches. And there's a distinction there. And then as we go on, we'll talk about Saul being selected as the first king of Israel. And I think God allows the selection of Saul for a reason. And he's an example of something. And we'll get into that. All right, especially in our study next week. But as we get into this one, we're in 1 Samuel chapter 8. That's kind of where we'll get started. But as you begin, Samuel, let's briefly just get us up to speed. Where are we? What's going on as we begin 1 Samuel? God has established judges, right? Who's the judge over Israel at this time? Eli. Who is Eli? Can somebody tell me a little bit about who he is as a judge? Were there good judges over Israel? Yeah, were there evil judges over Israel? Were a lot of them kind of a mixed bag? Yeah. So who was Eli as a judge, as a follower of God? Who was he? What are some things that stand out to you about him?
He mentored Samuel.
Okay, so he was the mentor for Samuel. We'll get into Samuel a little bit here in just a second, but yeah, he served as the mentor for him.
Even when he had been warned by God that what they were doing was evil, he would never seem to chastise them as he ought to.
Yeah, he's not a good father. I think you can say that. But why is that important? I know individually he may not have been a good father, but why is that important to the nation of Israel?
He sets a bad example for everybody.
Okay, he sets a bad example.
God brought them out of Egypt. All those things are indicative of not being taught. And
okay.
That was the judge's responsibility to some degree.
All right, so he's not setting the right example in how he leads his own children. We'll come back to that in just a second. What else can you say about Eli? Come on, you history buffs. You've done your study of 1 Samuel, all right?
He was a very meek man.
Meek man. Would you consider him a good judge? It's always a tough question when you evaluate, you know, somebody's life.
You got to teach and lead your children.
Yeah.
And he failed at that.
And he failed terribly, right?
Yeah.
And so when you go back and you read 1 Samuel, one of the reasons he was replaced by Samuel was the fact his children were so corrupt. He ended up, his sons died in battle. He was a very overweight man. He kind of led to his death. But especially,
broke his neck.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of a brutal way to go.
Yeah.
You know, there's sometimes the Bible describes death and of individuals, and sometimes they're kind of brutal. That was kind of brutal, right? But the reason I bring that up is not necessarily, I'm not trying to condemn Eli, right? I'm not trying to put him on trial. But what I want us to think about is how the nation would have viewed Eli and how that might have affected the future as the situation kind of comes up again. But here is the judge, the guy that's been appointed by God to not necessarily be he's not the king of Israel, but to be somewhat the idea, and I think it's very comparable to elders in the church today, right? Elders are not our dictators, they're not kings, right? But they're to be shepherds, right? They're to lead and guide and protect. And in some ways, that's what the judge did. And I think when you look at Eli, his greatest failure was with his children. And that led not just to a degradation of his own family and his own family's reputation, but it really did affect the nation as a whole. They were, what were the things they were doing? They were cheating the people. They were very corrupt in how, because they were to be the future leaders in Israel, and yet they're so corrupt. And the nation of Israel saw that. Now God removed them and put Samuel in his place, but the people saw that and it weighed on them. You know, when you go to the New Testament and you look at the qualification for elders, Paul, both to Timothy and to Titus, lays out for us qualifications for elders. One of those qualities is what? A man who You can go through that whole list, but one of them is that a man who rules his own household well. Now, Paul explains why that is the case. Why is it necessary for an elder to display shepherding as he would in the church in his home? Why is that important? What does Paul say?
Well, he says if he can't rule his own house, how's he going to rule the house of God?
Yeah, because it matters, right? That's there in his own home is kind of like not only the training ground for an elder, but it's also, it displays what kind of elder he's going to be. Right? And so I think there's a real good application of that comparison. And so you have the situation where you have Eli and his sons, and then you have Samuel come along. Now Samuel, very different, I think, from Eli. I think you go back to the situation surrounding his birth. You remember who's Samuel's mother?
Hannah,
right? You remember that scene there in 1 Samuel where she's out crying and she's just so heartbroken over the fact that she's barren, that she hasn't been able to have children, and so she's out there laying out her heart before God. Now Eli thinks she's drunk, and she's like, "I'm not drunk. I'm just heartbroken." I'm paraphrasing, but you know, but she makes a deal with God. What is it? What's that? She says, "If you'll allow me to have a child," again, I'm paraphrasing, but you can go back and read the text. She says, "I'll give him back to you. If you'll give me a child, I'll give him right back to you." And to Hannah's credit and to a display of her faith, she does exactly that. And that son is Samuel. And so after Samuel gets, beyond the years that he we might call weaned, he's old enough to be away from his mother, she gives him to Eli. And one of the unique things about Samuel is that he is a child of Nazarite vow. Now we think of other ones. Who's another famous Nazarite child? Samson, who was a judge, right? Just like Samuel. Now you can't really compare Samuel and Samson beyond that, right? But they both take that Nazarite vow where they never cut their hair. I imagine Samuel, when he was an older man, he must have had some hair, right? But he makes that vow, or she does with God. So he's a Nazarite by his mother's vow, interestingly enough. And so he's a good judge, and he does really well for many years. Let's go to 1 Samuel 8, and let's begin there. So, he's older now. 1 Samuel 8, time has passed. He's been a judge for a while now. Somebody read verses 1 through 3, please. 1 Samuel 8, 1 through 3. Who has that?
No, 1 Samuel 8, 1, 2, 3.
Yes, please.
"Now it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his son judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his secondborn, the name of his second, I'm not really doing well,
Abijah.
They were judges in Beersheba. His son did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice."
So it seems to be a similar situation to Eli, but a different, right? Eli is condemned by God because he refused to reprimand his sons. Now the same thing is not said about Samuel. It's just an indication here that his sons saw how he lived and they chose a different way. Which goes to all of us, we train up a child in the way he should go, and the prayer is that they'll go that way. But they don't have to. They can make their own choices. And obviously they've chosen wrongly, and they behaved in wrong ways. Verse 3 says, they did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain. And so they had become greedy, and had, instead of using their position to serve, they were using their position to get out of it what they could get out of it. And so, from the people's perspective, what do you think they see? What do you think the people of Israel are thinking when they see this?
Well, they were frustrated and angry because when they brought a gift to be given to God, the priests were stealing the sacrifice, taking more than their share, not offering the sacrifice that it was supposed to be offered. So.
And here we are going through all this again. You know, we just went through this with Eli and his children. And now look, here's another judge, and his children are doing the same thing. And so they begin to see a cycle. And they weren't doing what was right. And so you get to verses 4 and 5. Somebody read those next two verses, please. All right, so what they see is corruption, a cycle of corruption. Now, what's their response to that? Well, we need a new system. We need to do things differently. Are they asking the right question? Underlining question here. They're like, well, there's got to be a better way. We need a king. We need a king who can judge us and rule over us. So we can be like everybody else. See, they're all fine, right? This is part of that. It's always nicer on the other side of the fence. The grass is always greener. The house is always looks better. It's got, you know, and it's got all the things I want. So let me have that house. Let me have that yard. And the thing you don't see are all the cracks and all the weeds and all the things that your eyes don't want to see when you're standing on the other side. Instead of asking a question, why are the judges' children behaving like this, and how can we help to, you know, to improve that situation, let's just change up the situation. Let's do something different. Let's not go and ask God what to do. We'll just help God out. And that's just what Abraham and Sarah tried to do, and others have tried to help God out. And so they say, give us a king. Now we go on here, and we note Samuel's reaction. Can you click on that, Neil? Thank you. So go down to verse 6 and 7. Here it says, but the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, obey the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. So Samuel, what's his natural reaction to what they're doing? Well, as all of us, or most of us would probably do, is we take it personally. And we think, well, what have I done to deserve this? You know, why are they treating me like this? They are rejecting me from being judged because they've judged me as being wrong in some way. And so he takes it very personal. But God points out something to him, to Samuel. And what is it? You know, we go and maybe we set up a Bible study with someone who's not a member of the church, or maybe we go to someone who is a member of the church but has gone off into sin, and we go and we try to talk to them about their life and about the Bible and how their life is not lining up with it. And sometimes people do what? Sometimes they accept it, right? And they're willing to make change. They're willing to do what God... Not everybody does that, do they? Sometimes they reject it. Sometimes they get mad about it. Sometimes they lash out at us. And what do? What's the first instinct? Take it personal. They're attacking me. Why are they doing this to me? I'm a kind person. I meant this for their good, and they're mad at me. We're not looking deeply enough, are we? What's it really about?
Rejecting God's
will. Well, he's doing just what God said. They're rejecting him, right? They're rejecting the truth. They're not mad at you. You haven't done anything but show them the truth. Now, if you've done something wrong, then you need to repent of that. But if you've just simply tried to show them out of love the truth and they reject the truth, it's not them rejecting you. It's that they refuse to see the truth. And so there is Samuel, and I'm sure I would do the same thing. I'd be upset about it. You know, what if as a preacher sometimes you get fired because people don't like what you say? That ever happened? We never had a church that fired a preacher because they didn't like what he was saying. It'd be easy for the preacher to take that very personal. Now, if he's not preaching the truth, if he's not doing what he should do, then he probably should take it personal. But maybe it is that people don't want to face the truth. And so God says, they are not rejecting you. They're rejecting me. And God does take it very personally because it really is an attack on him. And what Israel failed to see in their great enlightenment of give us a king was that they already had a king. Who was their king? It was God. Go to Psalms 47. I want to just read this. Psalm 47 and the discussion about the true king of Israel and what they just simply failed to see. Somebody read that for me, please. Psalm 47. Yeah, please. Go ahead.
To the chief musician, a psalm for the sons of Korah. Oh, clap your hands, all ye people. Shout unto God with the voice of triumph. For the Lord Most High is terrible. He is a great king over all the earth. He shall subdue the people under us and the nations under our feet. He shall choose our inheritance for us, the excellence of Jacob, whom he loved.
Selah.
God has gone up with a shout, the Lord with the sound of a trumpet. Sing praises to God, sing praises unto our King, sing praises. For God is the King of all the earth, sing ye praises with understanding. God reigneth over the heaven, God sitteth upon the throne of his holiness. The prince of the people are gathered together, even the people of the God of Abraham. For the shields of the earth belong unto God. He is greatly exalted.
I think it's interesting in Psalm 47, that little note there, now it's not in the text, but it notes that this is a psalm of whom? The sons of?
Korah.
You remember Korah from Numbers, I believe 14, or 18, somewhere right in there. But anyway, it's in that, in that era, 14 to 18, I believe. And Korah, of course, was the one who led that rebellion. He ended up getting swallowed up in the earth. These are his sons that is thought to have written this. I think that's kind of interesting to think about. But they're singing out to what? To the praise of God as king. They say, God is king of all the earth. Of all the men who've served as king over any nation, imagine God being your king. And they're saying that God is the king of all the earth. God is the king of Israel. And Israel failed to appreciate that, failed to realize that. And so they believe, well, we need a man to serve as king. We need some human entity to judge us and to rule over us. And so they don't appreciate God. Instead of singing out his praises, they would rather reject God in pursuit of a human. It is a form of idolatry at the heart of it, because we pursue men over God, and it goes to our lust. Yes, sir.
Rejected Christ because he wasn't the kind of king they were looking for. Mm-hmm. And that goes all the way back here. They're rejecting God, but God wasn't the kind of king that they were looking for, mm-hmm. that they were expecting.
Yeah, exactly. It becomes the Israel problem. All right. Let's go back to 1 Samuel 8. 1 Samuel 8, 8 and 9, it says, according to all the deeds that they have done, from the day I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are also doing to you. Now then, obey their voice. Only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them. And so God relents into their rebellion. You know, sometimes God just allows us to go into rebellion. God doesn't force us into his pattern, right, or into a relationship with him. He will allow us to walk away. Now that only goes for so long. Eventually, retribution will be paid. But if we choose to reject God, he will allow us to reject him. He will allow us to walk away. And so it's really incumbent on us to think soberly about the choices we make. And Israel was not doing that. And so God says, I'm going to allow them to reject me, but I want you to tell them something. I want you to give them warning. Now, I think it's also interesting. We see also the mercy of God, that even in the midst of their rejection, God doesn't just throw them aside and give up on them. He says to Samuel, I want you to warn them. You know, much of God's word is a warning against rebellion, a warning against sin, and its devastating effects. And so he says to Samuel, warn them. Now we go on down to verses 10 through 18, a little bit longer section here, but I think all this is important. So Samuel told all the words of the Lord, verse 10, to the people who were asking for a king from him. He said, these will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. Now he's told Samuel, go and warn them. I want them to go into this with a clear understanding of what they're asking for. They're not just going to get a king. They're going to get some other things. And so by making this choice, he says, verse 11, these will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots, to be his horsemen, to run before his chariot. Notice that. To run before his chariots. He will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and to make his implements of war and the implements of his chariots. Before we get into the daughters, notice what he's saying there. Did you catch what he's emphasizing? He says, he will take your sons and he will point them to what? To his chariots, to his horsemen, to run before his chariots. He will point them to what? To be, to plow his ground, to reap his harvest, to make his implements and equipment for his chariots. What's the emphasis there?
Yes.
Everything belongs to the king.
The king is going to take. Now, if you compare that, you lay that up against what those kings are going to do against what God has done, they look very differently. What did God take from the children of Israel? Nothing. He gave them land to plant, to harvest. He gave them victories. He gave them wealth. And all he asked in return was what? Devotion. He goes on in verse 13. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his servants. Man, is that's not a condemnation of communism. I don't know what it is, by the way. He's going to take your stuff. He's going to take it from Si, and he likes Mark really well, so he's going to give them to Mark. That's what he's saying. And that's what kings do. Look at politics today. Politicians have people on them like flies on rotten fruit. Why do they have so many hangers-on? Because they want yours to be given to them. I have not done that. I'm talking about God. He had not done that to them. And yet that's the very thing they're asking for. Verse 15, he will take a tenth of your grain. So after everything else he's taken, he's going to take a tenth of your grain as tax and of your vineyards and give it to, notice this, he will give it to his officers and to his servants. He will take your male servants and your female servants and the best of your young men and your donkeys, and he will put them to his work. He will take the tenth of your flocks, and you shall be his slaves. And in that day you will cry out. Now notice this. They're crying for a king now. God says, in that day, what are you going to do? You're going to cry out because of your king. And notice what he says. Your king. You asked for this. Now keep all this in mind when we get into the kings. You're going to cry out because of it. Now, you cried out in Egypt, I came and delivered you. Don't think I'm going to come back and deliver you again. Whom you've chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. That is a sober warning. Unfortunately, they don't listen to it. Notice verse 19. But the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, who was really the voice of God. And they said, no, no, but there shall be a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us, notice this, and fight our battles. They've taken Jehovah God and replaced him with a man. That's idolatry. You worship the creature over the Creator. God has been doing all those things for them. I'll fight your battles. I have fought your battles. And yet, here you are, rejecting me for a weak man. For a weak, sinful man. There is a human condition that amazes me when I noticed it. We as human beings love to idolize men. And I'm talking about in general, men and women. The human. Think about the idols we have. Politically, we idolize politicians. I've never understood it. Do you not see their life and how messed up they are and all the dumb things they say? We idolize them. Look at Hollywood. There are a bunch of lunatics in Hollywood. Not all of them, but there are a bunch of lunatics in Hollywood, and we idolize them. Rock stars who are drug addicts. I mean, what are we doing? I heard somebody, a comedian, talk about this, but he said, you know, when I was a child, I used to look at my adults and thought, oh, look at adults and think, all they know, right? Man, they're so much smarter. Then I became an adult, and I noticed all those dummies that were in class with me, all the adults making those decisions. And I realized something. People don't know that much. People are faulty. Now, I'm not trying to. I have my own faults, right? I'm imperfect in so many ways. Why do I think this other person is perfect and has all the answers? Truth is, we're all imperfect. There's only one perfect being, God. Why don't we idolize Him instead of looking to men to fight our battles? Verses 21 and 22. And when Samuel heard all the words of the people, he repeated them in the ears of the Lord. I didn't think about how defeated Samuel must have felt in that moment. Here's all his work that he's tried to do. I just think about how defeated I would be in that moment. You think about even as an elder, right, and you've tried to work with a family or you maybe with the church itself, and you just seem like everything you do is just not getting through. You're a missionary and you've been in the mission field and you've tried and you toil away. And I think about how defeated you might be. I think about Elijah, right? He was on the mountain and he saw the great miracle of God, and the chapter later he's down in the cave under the mountain. Not just physically, but emotionally. And I think about that, and I think even more so God. I'm not saying God felt defeated, but how down he must have felt toward all these people that he's shown love to over and over again, grace and mercy. And yet here they are again, they're just doing the same things they always do. Verse 22, and the Lord said to Samuel, obey their voice and make them a king. Samuel said to the men of Israel, go every man to his city. And the decision was made, a decision that would cost them dearly. A little bit we have left, we'll kind of transition our thought. But do you have any questions about any of that before I do? Kind of a different mode here. But any questions or comments about that? All right, so we go on now. The decision's been made, and now we're moving forward. And so what we have here on is really getting into the material of the class, but I think all that establishes the framework from what we're going to be talking about. Saul, who is Saul? Let's go on to 1 Samuel chapter 9. Verses 1 and 2, the text reads there, there was a man of Benjamin, of the tribe of Benjamin, whose name was Kish, the son of Abel, a son of Zizor, a son of Bechorath, son of Aphi, a Benjaminite. Now, I could have asked somebody to read that one, and now y'all get to hear me make those mistakes, or not be able to pronounce those names. He had a son whose name was Saul, a handsome young man. There was not a man among the people of Israel more handsome than he. What a statement to be made, right? Physically, Brad Pitt ain't got anything on this dude, right? From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. All dark and handsome. Here's tall, dark, and handsome. When I was younger, and I was a senior in high school, I had an older lady tell me, you know, you'll make a good preacher one day because you're tall. I was like, really? I don't know, maybe someday. But, you know, here is the picture of human human perfection from the eyes of what the world looks for, right? He's tall, commanding. He's not bad to look at. You know, he's many of the things that people look forward to. I mean, you just look at who are the idols, right? Not a lot of us ugly people get to be idols in society, do they? They don't come looking for overweight, middle-aged, you know, graying dudes, right? There's a certain picture, right? And here is Saul, and he is the picture of what so many pursue. Next week, we'll get into Saul and talk a little bit more about who he was and how he was selected. I think it's important. We're going to, as we go along, we're going to compare the man that the people chose versus the man God will choose. Now, God doesn't want them to have a king. You know, he had established a different way. But since they've gone down this route, there's going to be a comparison to be made between the man the people chose versus the man that whom Scripture says was a man after God's own heart. And we'll notice those differences. Thank you all. We'll jump into that next week.